From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, a return visit from Dr. Fred Bell, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. And if you have some time, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at some of his new machinery that he has invented. Here's some quick stories of the day before we get into this hour's guest. Well, people that mix alcohol with caffeinated energy drinks are at a higher risk for alcohol-related injuries. Be careful. Those who drink regular cocktails, for example, are better off, they say, according to new research from Wake Forest University School of Medicine. The researchers found that students, for example, who drank the energy cocktails were twice as likely to be hurt or injured, twice as likely to require medical attention, and twice as likely to ride with an intoxicated driver. The study also found students who drank alcohol mixed with energy drinks were more than twice as likely to take advantage of someone and almost twice as likely to be taken advantage of. Several people on a Boston-bound flight were taken to a local hospital when they reported feeling sick after landing at Logan's International Airport. Five U.S. air crew members complained of flu-like symptoms shortly after landing in Boston. They were taken to the hospital. They had elevated levels of carbon monoxide. None of the 81 passengers on board reported feeling sick. Well, Pakistan said that it will now hold a national election by mid-January and that President Musharraf pledged to quit the military after criticism from the United States for imposing emergency rule. Musharraf has detained hundreds of lawyers and opposition politicians since taking emergency powers on Saturday. A move seen as designed to preempt the Supreme Court ruling on his re-election as president last month. President George W. Bush, who values Musharraf as an ally in his battle against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, urged Pakistan's president to lift the state of emergency, hold the elections, and quit his military post. The Google phone is official, well, sort of, confirming its long-rumored move into the cell phone market. The company has announced that it's finishing up a mobile software package that will include an operating system and applications and cost absolutely nothing. But in keeping with a company policy that won't allow fancy cars, for example, in the parking lot at its Mountain View, California headquarters, Google is refusing to call its creation the Google phone. Instead, the project is called Android, after the startup company that Google gobbled up in 2004 for its software. And Google won't be making or marketing any phones itself. Android developers plan to release a software development kit within a couple of weeks, but phones that come loaded with the platform won't hit the market until the middle of next year. China's first lunar module has begun orbiting the moon 12 days after blasting off. The satellite slowed down as it reached lunar gravitational pull, 120 miles from the moon. Scientists intend to keep the probe in orbit for 1 year while it studies the surface and beams back images. On the coasttocoastam.com website under Hot Stories, you must go and look at the picture of the toddler with eight limbs. Many believe that this little child is the reincarnation of a Hindu god, Vishnu. Well, the little child is set to undergo a 40-hour operation to remove half of her limbs. She was joined in a parasitic twin and will undergo the knife at the hands of 30 surgeons. They want to remove two of her useless arms and legs. She cannot walk or crawl and is unlikely to survive her teens without the surgery. Just go take a look at the picture if you want. Cute little baby. I hope she's okay. A German church steeple has knocked the Leaning Tower of Pisa from the Guinness Book of Records as the world's most lopsided building. The tower applied in June for the title and has now officially beaten the famous landmark in Pisa. The Guinness Book of World Records confirms the award after officials measured it leaning at 5.19 degrees angle compared to only 3.97 at which the Tower of Pisa leans. You know, I've been in St. Louis waiting for my daughter to have her little baby boy, and looks like it's not going to happen while I'm here, and I'm going to be going back to L.A. next week. But tonight I took all my children out to dinner, and Wendy, the expectant mother, showed me an ultrasound of little Gavin. And she said, Dad, you got to look at this. She's really into the show and a lot of the subject matter that we've done for all these years. And she says, please look at the ultrasound. You've got to look at it. And she's darn serious. And I said, well, yeah, let me look at it. And she said, Dad, Gavin's going to be an alien or he's a hybrid. There's something wrong here. He's just, it's strange. So I said, come on, Wendy. So she shows me the ultrasound picture. And I said, where is he? And she said, he's over here in the corner. And I got to tell you, I looked at this picture, and it was like a little baby alien gray. You know, the big head, the big eyes. And I'm looking at it, and I'm going, I can't believe this. And I'm not telling her that. And she says, Dad, he's an alien. And I'm saying, Wendy, little Gavin's not over there. He's over on the other end of this picture. And over on the far end was this little tiny face of a little tiny child with little tiny eyes and a little tiny nose. And right now they estimate that he's 5.5 pounds, far from being an alien or a hybrid. And she still doesn't believe me. But in a moment, we're going to be back with an expert on aliens and UFO abductions, our friend Bud Hopkins. He's with us this entire hour on Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, world-renowned artist, author, pioneer, UFO abduction researcher, having investigated hundreds of cases, and he now heads the Intruders Foundation, which is a not-for-profit scientific research and support organization. We're very pleased to have him this hour, and we'll take phone calls a little bit later on. Bud, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Well, fine. Thank you, George. Glad to be with you.
You know, that story I was talking about my daughter, she was serious. She thought she had a little hybrid on her hands.
Well, I don't know that an exact clear picture from an ultrasound of what the little baby's going to finally look like.
He was on the other side of the picture, and I pointed it out to her. But how have you been? What have you been up to?
Well, I just gave a seminar here for IF, for our organization, and I covered a lot of things. I haven't been giving solos. Seminars, we usually have guests on various subjects, mostly connected with abductions, but I decided to do one by myself for a change. And we had a really full house. It was very interesting. But one of the things that I decided to talk about was one theme within the whole complexity of the abduction phenomenon, and that is the fact that there have been, you know, a number of cases where airplanes have apparently been affected in the air and sometimes made to disappear, or there are cases, I have three cases, where three private pilots, these separate cases, were flying their planes, small private planes, and ended up being in the air for something like 2 hours or an hour longer than they had fuel for, and they simply could not account for what had happened to them. One of them was encountering in daylight a huge UFO. One of the other pilots, when he landed, was informed that the officials had been searching for his plane because he hadn't followed the flight plan. It was so late. And he later, and he's a physician, understood memories that connected this with an abduction, as if the entire plane had been taken and then put back in the sky with enough fuel to land. This, of course, is a kind of a very famous situation when we think of that Fred Valentich, the pilot who disappeared, plane and all.
That's the Australian, right? Yeah.
That was 1978, and he was last heard on the radio describing this craft that was above his plane, and his engine was choking out, and he said, it is definitely not an aircraft. And the plane was never found. There was never any wreckage, oil slick. There was a massive search, and Valentich and the plane has never turned up. And there's another case that I went into, which happened in 1953, Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod, where an interceptor was sent up to actually intercept and chase away, I suppose, a UFO. And at 1,500 feet, the plane lost all electrical power, and the pilot ordered an evacuation ejection to the radar operator. The canopy was blown off, of course, when they eject, and he came down by parachute, and the plane was never found, nor was the radar operator, and the pilot and the canopy, which landed on the ground, the pilot was okay, are the only things that were left from this. So we have a whole history. There are many other cases. A lot of these we can't really present much evidence to support what happened, but the ones that we don't have much evidence for are certainly extremely curious when we look into it, because they do fit the patterns of these car lifting cases or automobile or airplane lifting cases. The coin helicopter incident over Ohio, when the object came right, the UFO came right at the helicopter, the frightened pilot put it in dive. And this whole thing was seen from the ground by people in the automobile. And when the object flew away, it was just a matter of a minute or two, the pilot checked the altitude and found that his helicopter had gone up 2,000 feet instead of, even though the controls were in a dive, as if the thing had been somehow lifted. So the power of the UFO phenomenon over our simple little airplanes and cars and so on seems to be extraordinary.
And you know, Bud, with witness accounts or just even the pilot's account, nobody would come back and concoct a story like that.
No, absolutely not. And one of the things that I raised, because it is just a mystery, we have absolutely no reason to connect this with UFOs whatsoever. But it is a mystery, and that is, of course, the ongoing mystery of what happened to Steve Fawcett.
Yes, absolutely.
A pilot who was in a private plane, an extremely experienced pilot, and it had a beacon, a signal piece of equipment for safety built in, so if the plane crashed or something, it would send off the signal. There's a massive search over a relatively small area where he was known to have flown, and they found no wreckage and nothing and no word from him. And so there may be some very logical explanation, which we don't understand. Dr. Lear has presented one possibility that he strayed too close to Area 51 and was shot down.
And then they realized who he was, and they're embarrassed to say anything or something.
Yeah, that's what he said, but there's still going to be wreckage somewhere. If a plane is hit. But at any rate, there's no evidence for that either. So we have one way or the other, we have a massive mystery. So this is just one more of what I consider a particular subgroup of cases, patterns. And that's one of the themes that I went into during my talk.
Gosh, it's just amazing, Bud. And it just never seems to stop it. It's almost as if whatever is doing this, they're getting more and more aggressive.
Right. Well, you know, the famous case over Iran in 1976, which the Defense Intelligence Agency reported in a long document, when two of the Shahs, he was running Iran at the time, the Shah's Air Force intercepted a very large UFO, and when they got ready to fire their rockets at it, they were ordered to. They lost all power, and the planes were headed for a crash until the power came back on again. But this is something that was, the report was, according to the documents we have, the report was sent to the White House, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the CIA, and so forth. So here we have another one of these signs that the UFO has abilities to control what aircraft do and how they can escape and how the UFO can protect itself against them.
But, you know, with the abduction cases that have been ongoing and publicized really since the Barney and Betty Hill cases, are they, you know, short-term abduction cases? Are they long-term? What do you think?
Well, I think the cases are mostly short-term, but I did go into one incident, which I actually would rather not talk about on the air, because for a lot of reasons. But as a young man, I have interviewed, and he was definitely missing for a period of a year and a half. And there are a lot of indications that he has no idea where he was for that length of time. And there are a lot of indications that this may have been a long-term abduction. These are cases where we're making some guesses. We cannot defend them with any kind of serious evidence, but we do have to consider them. In the past, most abduction cases, and practically all of the mass of them, have lasted, you know, an hour, 2 hours, that sort of thing. Although I have a few that lasted a couple of days, and of course, in the Travis Walton case, it was a 5-day abduction. But that was there are these little subgroups within the basic pattern, which are extremely interesting. And one other thing I should mention is that Dr. Don Dundary, who's a psychologist, a research psychologist at McGill University, came down from Montreal this past weekend so we could confer and he could come to the seminar and so forth. But he has been helping me with an examination of my collection of alien symbols that something like 45 different people have described to me as things they saw inside a UFO. And these are incredibly similar. And some kinds of psychological experiments have been done on a control group who were asked to come up with alien symbols that they would invent, and they are all over the map, and they have no similarity in the control group to these highly similar symbols, which have never been made public for the reason that they give me a way to help support the veracity of individual abductees I'm working with.
But you've been doing this now for a long, long time. You never seem to tire. You're in there, you know, fighting the good fight. I had an opportunity several weeks ago to get Jacques Vallée on the program. Never thought I'd get him to come back and talk. Mm-hmm. What a delightful individual he is. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the community is finally starting to get its due. Is that just my feeling, or is that happening?
Absolutely. I think we've made incredible headway, at least with the public. I think when I began working with this 30-some years ago, and then ultimately other people who I sort of persuaded to look into this, like David Jacobs and later on John Mack and so on, more and more people were taking this seriously in the scientific community and so on. At the beginning, probably the public, maybe 4 or 5% back 30 years ago, might have said they thought abductions were real and going on. And I think now that's probably up to maybe 35% or something of the population that would support that. So we're doing something right. And this brings me to the other to another important point, and that is how to do things wrong. And I've been extremely upset by what's been happening with people who call themselves exopoliticians, dealing with what they call exopolitics, mm-hmm. who have been holding press conferences and so forth and bringing incredible amounts of ridicule on serious UFO research. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I would never say anything like that, but they're doing exactly what you would imagine the CIA or whatever cover-up organization would like to see done. In other words, if there is an MJ-12 type of situation, which I Right. suspect there is, they would want nothing better than to have a group who simply go to the press and make fools out of themselves and make all sorts of incredible assertions that end up giving the press wonderful opportunities of making fun. I don't know whether you're aware of the article that the Washington Post printed, a completely satirical piece after this ex group. And it turns out that at that so-called press conference that they ran, they just simply hand-fed the press with the most ludicrous assertions, which they could not back up. They accused Governor Bill Richardson as having been, the quote is, as a 25-year-old, he was an employee of a secret extraterrestrial liaison.
See, you got to have the facts. But stay with us. We've got to take this quick break. We'll come back and chat more. And we'll also open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with one of the giants in the field of UFO abductions, Bud Hopkins. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. I got to tell you, when you look at how the system works, the Internet, it's absolutely incredible. Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul, who's been on this program with me, the Texas congressman, raised today nearly $4 million online. Observers say it's the most money raised by a candidate on the web in a single day. What's so incredible about this is his record performance in doing that, and he's just not getting the kind of publicity he needs from the mainstream media. It just absolutely astounds me. I'm not taking political sides. We don't do that here. But the way he has used the Internet to get grassroots support from so many Americans and to raise nearly $4 million in one day, the biggest fundraising haul ever in a single day, is to me absolutely incredible. So his campaign deserves congratulations for simply doing that. I'll be back in a moment. Bud Hopkins and the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. But how do you weed through the good researchers from the not-so-good researchers media people can figure out what's going on?
Well, I think that the first thing that a good researcher does is he doesn't make an assertion, or she doesn't make assertions that are not backed by some kind of evidence. I mean, for instance, what I was saying about the ExoPals is that even though it's a tiny little fringe group, they're doing a lot of harm because they're going to the press and to the government and becoming, turning the press and the government, whatever branches and individuals there are there who favor the UFO subject, turning them absolutely against it, and making sure that there's enough peer pressure that reporters and congressmen are not going to do anything for this. And that's because of being very poor researchers. They're not really researchers. They're just making assertions that they can't back up. And if you tell the press, such as the Washington Post, that there is a, as one of these people did during the press conference, that there is a culture of advanced civilization, really, living beneath the ground on Mars, as a simple assertion. And your evidence that you present is that somewhere some remote viewer said that he saw that. I mean, you are handing the press the biggest joke in the world to kick around and play with. So a good researcher, somebody who backs up his assertions or his cases or whatever with at least some solid evidence that allows anybody who's objective to have something to chew on and decide whether this is there's something real about this. Just to bombard people with baseless assertions is just ridiculous. And many researchers do this, or many people in the UFO community will simply make assertions. I read one man recently saying that there's the aliens had these huge objects doing some sort of communication, whatever it is, and one of them, the evil Americans, brought down in Canada, and it was 8 miles wide or something like that, and then the aliens managed to get it back. And he wrote this on his website as if this was some sort of a real event. And of course, all this does is, you know, bring ridicule upon the serious researchers.
Sure. Now, do these people...
What they have found. Over the years, I've never written anything until... I've written four books in over those 32 years. I've never written anything unless I have already gathered a huge amount of evidence to support whatever points I was trying to make. I think that's the only way you can judge a good researcher is whether that kind of evidence is used to back his claims.
Well, and even then, Bud, because I've interviewed you many times now, you'll say, with all the evidence, I don't know what this is.
Well, here's the point. I always say, I can't prove this. There's something still like 10% of the population for whom it is not proved that there was a Holocaust. There's probably people somewhere who still think the world is flat. You can't necessarily prove something beyond a shadow of a doubt to everybody, but at least you can present enough information that you have to say, you have to look at this material.
Yes.
Because the evidence is there. And what the statements that I came up with when I did a program years ago with Carl Sagan instead of trying to persuade him that this was all real in some sort of persuasive way, I said, what we should be saying is that all of it, the evidence we have, constitutes an extraordinary phenomenon.
Yes.
And an extraordinary phenomenon demands an extraordinary investigation. The bad researchers are just people who don't even say we need an investigation. They will say we already know the truth. We know that people are living on Mars underground, and we know that Bill Richardson was a spy and so forth. And they just say they want the press to accept this. And, of course, the press laughs in their face. One of the things about that article, which you said you had read from the Washington Post, mm-hmm. that was such a satirical piece, was that some of these people, a couple of them, as I say, it's a very tiny fringe group, said that it was some kind of triumph because they were on the front page of the Washington Post. And all I could think of was they seemed to me to be like collectively a horrible tone-deaf singer who appears on American Idol and is laughed at and cruelly insulted by the hosts, and when he leaves, you know, that the whole thing is being played on YouTube and so forth the next day, and everybody's exchanging laughter around the country, and this person is home saying, hey, I was on TV.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what the sort of the glory that they seem to want. But in the meantime, they're doing damage to serious research that is far beyond their numbers, and it's of course a very unpleasant thing to have to see.
Well, we'll take some calls here, but one quick question: how do we know that they're not disinformation people, Bud? People that the government has thrown out there to be so preposterous?
Yeah.
It makes everyone laugh at it. Is that possible?
Well, George, of course, I suppose anything's possible. I think the I'm not a conspiracy type about such things. I don't think so. I think that there's that the basic thing ranges from hubris to actual stupidity to naivete, to put the best possible spin on it. Most of them fall into one of those or one or more of those categories. I don't think that, but they are in fact doing the work that a disinformation program would want done. They would want people like Alan Hynek and James McDonald and, you know, all the people of the past, the serious researchers, people at the Center for UFO Studies and the Fund for UFO Studies, people like Richard Hall and Bruce McAbee, there's all this, so many, many people, David Jacobs, myself, and all kinds of people. All the work that we're doing, they want somehow the cover-up situation wants to blast away by ridicule. And we've known all along that the basic weapon, the most effective weapon that the debunkers and I suppose those running the cover-up or whatnot, their basic weapon is ridicule. They're better at witness intimidation than the mafia is. And, of course, this is ridicule. So it has the same effect as if it were this disinformation program. But I don't think it is that. I think they have enough other, peculiar personal reasons for just saying this.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jody. Hi, George.
Hey, Jody.
I'm from Seattle. I want to say thank you to Bud. I was living in Piedmont Wildlife Refuge in Georgia in 1998. And at the time, I had been working on a murder case with the sheriff, and I had a gray appear when I was doing a deep meditation, and the gray came out. So it was 9 o'clock at night, and I called Bud, and he answered the phone. I got the New York directory. Mm-hmm. I was freaked out. So I called him, and he took my call, and he saved my life, I feel like, because I was terrified of him. And there was a lot in the Georgia area. And the thing happened, Bud, because you said, you know, you had mentioned something about, you know, they were intrusive and they did all sorts of really kind of unkind things. And they were just kind of an angry alien. So I really listened to that. And so what I did was I asked for help. Mm-hmm. And this is way out there. the Pleiadians came, which are the blue, like, glow. They're the little aliens. I call them aliens because that's all we referred them to as. But what they did was they came down, and I lost time, and I have it all documented. And even with the refuge, we have it where they hummed. The aircraft hummed really loud, and it lasted for, like, 2 months, humming on the refuge housing. And so they tested it and tested it. And so anyway, it turned out that the Pleiadians worked on me for 2 months, June till August.
Well, it's all very, very interesting. I just wanted to just correct one thing. I didn't say, I'm sure, I don't remember the incident, but that's my fault. But I get a lot of phone calls. But the point is that I wouldn't say that they do all these malevolent things. I've from the beginning said that I do not see the phenomenon as malevolent at all, nor do I see it in any sense as benevolent. They're following their own agenda. And the point about the whole abduction phenomenon is they're doing this for their purposes, and they're seemingly trying not to hurt people if they can avoid it at all. In order to carry out their program, which is sample taking and reproductive processes and so forth, that I've written about extensively. But it doesn't have the sense that these are enemies, horrible people. But the point is that there's no sign whatsoever that they're trying to be helpful. And we have to remember that the bottom line is, whatever they're doing, they're causing psychological damage to the people they're doing it to. There doesn't seem to be any doubt about that, simply because the psychological testing of people who have had these experiences reveals, in most cases, post-traumatic stress disorder. But I thank you very much for your call. It's very interesting. And I think we should probably try to take a couple more calls, if that's possible, George.
Yep, absolutely. And how long was Travis Walton gone?
5 days.
5 days, okay. Yeah. That was pretty long all by itself.
That's a long time, but we have other cases where I've had several which lasted 2 or 3 days. So, but they're very rare, but there's no reason to think that there mightn't be people taken for a longer time. I mean, a year or so even.
These longer times, if this is occurring, would you speculate that they might have taken them back to their, let's say, planet, or through the other dimension?
Well, anything is possible. And certainly, I don't know how they would handle somebody in a spaceship enclosed inside a UFO for a year.
A year. That'd be difficult.
I would imagine that there is something like... But you see, there have been so many cases. Recently, the English pilot... airlines pilot who sighted this gigantic object a mile wide.
Yeah.
In daytime, scared him to death. I don't know whether you've seen the clips of him being interviewed.
I have. And how could he be wrong?
Other people on the plane saw this thing too. But what I'm saying is, if you have something a mile long, you could have a whole, you know, a whole self-enclosed, self-perpetuating laboratory, so to speak, where food and everything is,
oxygen
is being produced. So we don't really know. George, we're at the real end of speculation here when we get into that, because we have no real evidence. But we do have the evidence, all the evidence we really have basically here about these sorts of things comes from the abductees themselves. And they're reporting the same kinds of things happening all the time. But from the alien point of view, we're not sure exactly how they live, you know, how they eat, although we have some evidence from abductees about how they seem to take nourishment and so on. So these issues of long-term abduction, we really don't know much about, but I do think they do happen occasionally.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on with Bud Hopkins. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
My name is Greg, and I'm from northern Arizona.
Okay.
10 years ago, we're all aware of the Phoenix Lights. We saw them here in Meadview as they left Nevada and came down over Prescott and down over Phoenix. And at that time, 10 years ago, Fife Simonson was our governor. And I'm just trying to let the people know that, yes, Bud's right, the manipulation of the public. At that time, he had made fun of us, and he said that he didn't see them, and it was just a fiasco. He had the Martian come out on the stage, and everybody.
Yeah. Well, and he apologized for that. He's apologized for that now.
Yes, he has, and now he has come out here just recently, now that he's not governor, and he made the statement publicly after advertising his public company that he had seen the lights.
Yes.
Well, I called. I have a UFO tour company up here, and I called down there to Phoenix to a certain news channel, and I tried to get a hold of him, but the producer of the show basically said that he kind of told a little fib. He did not see the lights. He was just going along with the program because so many had seen the lights.
Well, this is something that my colleague Leslie Kane has been very involved with in many conversations with him, and I think that in the near future that it's going to be clarified even further, and that's all I'll say about it.
Okay, good. So we're all on the same page, and I do have a UFO.
Well, I'm not on the page that he's. The most important thing here that you said, bearing on what we've been talking about generally, is the fact that the first thing that was done by Governor Simonson to calm things down when he felt things were getting out of hand and with the public demanding investigations was to turn to ridicule. And to have his assistant or whoever it was come out in an alien mask. This is exactly the thing that, of course, will happen if we can give them the chance, you know, if we give them information, opportunities, the press or the debunkers or whoever, whatever group is,
sure,
is keeping a lid on, they'll turn to ridicule every single solitary time.
All right, let's go.
So, anyway, we thank you for your call.
Final call, wild card line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's an honor and blessing to talk to you.
Thank you.
Hi, Bud.
Hi there.
A quick question. I'm Tammy. I'm from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I have a quick question. Is it possible that if you suffer sleep paralysis or just haven't slept in a long time that you can attract aliens? Because I've had a couple of strange experiences in my day where, like, I will be sleep deprived, haven't slept for a while, and just the strangest, most scary things have happened to me.
Well, see, first of all, I don't see that there's any connection between sleep paralysis and the abduction phenomenon. There may be in a few cases of people who have sleep paralysis occur, which generally lasts only a matter of seconds. In other words, sleep paralysis and something goes on for half an hour. it's a very fleeting phenomenon. And I suppose that some people could have that phenomenon occur and somehow connected with an abduction story or something like that. But essentially, there really is no connection because we have so many abductions where people are driving cars and there are four or five people together of different ages and everything else, and it all happens simultaneously. There's no possible way sleep paralysis is involved. And there's certainly no way in which sleep paralysis, quote unquote, attracts aliens. I don't think anything attracts a visit. I think that the UFO occupants seem to know who they want to deal with, and they deal with that person over and over again. Most often, people are often picked up in childhood, and again, as if a person is targeted, perhaps.
All right, Bud. Thank you so much, Bud Hopkins. His website, it's located on coasttocoastam.com.